Welcome to the pilot episode of the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Today's episode is with Hannah Williams, the creator of Salary Transparent Street. Her project blew up on TikTok overnight back in April 2022, literally gaining 50,000 followers in the first night alone. And now Hannah's brand has over 1.3 million followers on TikTok alone, not to mention their followings on all the other platforms. It's a full-fledged media business that brought in $1 million in revenue last year. I hope you enjoy this pilot episode of the Creator Spotlight Podcast, and if you have any feedback, please send it to editor@creatorspotlight.com. To start, you know, for our readers, listeners, subscribers, give me the quick overview. Who is Hannah Williams? What is Salary Transparent Street?
Yeah, so hi, I'm Hannah Williams from Salary Transparent Street. Salary Transparent Street is a page I started with my husband in April of 2022. Basically, what we do is we ask people what they do for a living and how much they make. The whole point of the page was I found out I was underpaid. I used to be a senior data analyst in the DC metro area. Found out I was making about $20,000 to $25,000 less than people in the same role doing the same thing as me in my market. And, you know, I just encountered so much pay secrecy in my career that I realized it was something that needs more of a platform. And I took to my phone to the streets and my husband and, you know, here we are.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I feel like I'm starting to find that the best, most successful, let's say, projects come from like people like you who are like, see, you know, they're looking for something and they see a gap, like you are looking for more information on like what you should be paid, couldn't really find it, or it was like hidden. So, you know, you decide to make this thing. And I think I'm seeing that with a lot of other people. But before Salary Transparent Street, you had another TikTok account that I believe was called like Stocks and Squats. Now it still exists, but it's just your name. And I was looking at it and I see that you started in 2020, you posted like three times in like the preceding like year and a half or so, and then January 2022 you started doing these like, you know, front-facing camera like talking about employment and recruiting and like salary negotiation, the kind of things that, you know, you'd go on to do, and then like I believe you got 40,000 followers in 4 months, and then start, which is already also crazy, and then started Salary Transparent Street. So tell me like why you started like TikToking on that account, and then why you decided to like spin off this whole separate project.
Yeah, I love that you did your research because nobody ever brings up Stocks and Squats. And I think it's such an important part of my story, right? Like you mentioned, I posted three times in 2020. It was the first time I got a TikTok account, you know, everybody else and their mother over the panini, you know, we all got TikTok. And they were just like fun videos, like I'd made a puzzle in one, like I've never had a desire to be a creator. I don't really have much of a digital footprint. That desire to be a YouTuber or an influencer was never something that I wanted or thought that I could do. So it's never something that I basically sought after until January of 2022. And even then, I don't even think I would say that I was seeking, you know, being an influencer. I started creating those videos because that was right when I accepted my new job as a senior data analyst after I had found out I was underpaid. So I got an offer after finding out I was underpaid for $115K, tried to negotiate it. Basically, I bumped up my salary $25,000, the amount I knew I was underpaid, overnight, it felt like. And I in that moment realized I need to talk about this because like this experience is crazy and I resolved it, but this doesn't solve the problem. You know, the systemic issue is still pervasive and affecting people every single day. So I just realized, you know, there is value in starting to talk about it. So I was like, okay, let me dip my toe in TikTok. And as I made more videos, one of my most popular ones is where I shared every salary I had at all of my jobs. And I was, you know, the feedback on that video was such a light bulb that I was like, I knew this was an issue, but the feedback confirms that this is also an issue for other people. And it's not just something that I'm complaining about, you know? And that inspired me so much to start Salary Transparent Street. Like people that were following me there were hearing me say, I have an idea, like I'm going to go on the street. And I feel kind of bad because I, you know, like I said, I don't consider myself like, I never wanted to be a creator, and running two accounts full time is incredibly difficult. So almost as soon as Salary Transparent Street started, I like abandoned that account because I've just kind of been following the mission. I don't want to be the person, you know, selling stuff on TikTok shop. I just love that I can use my phone to have social impact.
Yeah, no, that's great. So you still post on it sometimes, though. I was looking.
Sometimes. Yeah. I've tried to get back into it, but I'm just more so using it as like a break. You know, like I create content that I think is fun and like just about my life, you know, things that make me laugh versus like hard hitting education.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's really interesting because like I obviously for a living write this newsletter, Creator Spotlight, but then I have another one that's like just for fun that like the 20 friends follow that is just like a creative outlet for me to like write a few hundred words every week. So I'm interested, like what does that do for you having that other, because I think it's important personally. So like, is it important to you to have that as a creative outlet or why?
Absolutely. It's so important to have that as a creative outlet because the burnout is real. Like what I tell people, the best way to give an example of what our work is it's constantly being on a hamster wheel. The internet is not a 9-to-5. It is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's very exhausting to constantly be focused on this one thing. And then just like, sometimes you have these ideas for your content and they don't perform, you know, and it's constantly just like shooting dice or, you know, arrows at the wall and hoping, or spaghetti at the wall and hoping it sticks. So having a creative outlet, like a profile where I'm like, there's no pressure here for me to perform. There's no pressure for analytics. I don't care if this video gets 2 views. I don't care if it gets 1,000. I don't even look at the comments. Like to me, that helps me stay grounded in my joy of creating content and what I love about the internet.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think that's really important. And like people would do well to remember that.
Yeah.
So this same article I read, which was written about 2 months after you launched Sally Transparent Street, said that you had about 600,000 followers on TikTok already. Mm-hmm. And that's crazy to me because now you have about 1.3 million, which is, you know, only twice as much, huge number, but only twice as much. So I'm curious about like the audience growth journey and, you know, just TikTok for now and then maybe getting into the other platforms. But was it really just so meteoric and then it kind of steady after that? Or how did that happen?
Meteoric is an understatement. Like, I think I went to bed the first night, like April 16, 2022, 0 followers, like a completely blank slate. First video, no followers. When I woke up the next morning, I think we had like 50K. And, you know, like you said, it took me 4 months to get 40K on my personal account. So like, that is so, it was in that moment that I realized, you know, I've definitely got something here. Like this is crazy. And as it kept growing, you know, the 600K in the first few months, it was definitely a confirmation that we could create a business out of it and, you know, actually continue doing this. But it was also a little scary. And I wouldn't recommend it. I almost wish that we had the slow burn because when we grew so fast, it almost felt like we didn't know who our audience was because there were so many different types of people. Like on TikTok, we're not just popular in the United States. We have an audience like in India, in Nigeria, in Australia, in Canada. And I'm like, I don't, you know, how do I make sure that I'm catering to their needs as well? And Americans. And it was very difficult to kind of understand who our community and our audience was. But, you know, over time, we're almost 2 years old. We've definitely defined who our audience is and what they want. And that really just comes down to being very engaged with them. You can't create a platform like this and have a meteoric rise and immediately start getting an ego. I encourage our audience to give us critical feedback. Whenever we have meetups, I'm like, what am I doing wrong? What do you want to see? What are we not doing? And I take that feedback incredibly to heart because that's who I'm creating content for. You know, I started this as a little hobby, but at the end of the day, the impact is with them. And if I'm not meeting their needs, they're going to unfollow me, you know, and that's murder in this industry. So I really need to make sure that I understand them. So having that meteoric rise was difficult to have an understanding of them. But as long as you're engaged, which is what we did, I think we've figured it out.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. Thank you for that. You get this huge audience and you're like, great. But yeah, it's like, what do you do with it? Which I think so many people starting out, like people I hear from writing this newsletter, like they don't even have an audience in mind and like a specific audience. And I think like that's so crucial, which looking at your work, it, you know, my impression was that at the beginning, the audience is just like people who live in America and have a job and like maybe have anxiety about how much they're paid or like want to make more money, which is, you know, you could say that's like the entire adult population of this country. So was that like basically it was as simple as that at the beginning? And how has that changed over time? Like, what has it developed to now?
Yeah, it was definitely a general overview when we started. We were like, people that are looking for jobs, you know, that's all we knew. And now, you know, reading the comments, reading the DMs and talking to people, we've been able to really break out our audience into specific groups. And they're all different, right? There's the younger Gen Z demographic, and they're usually looking for opportunities. And in that same vein, we have Gen X, believe it or not. People think that our biggest community or followers are Gen Z, but actually our audience skews largely older millennial and Gen X, because a lot of them will comment and say, I sent this to my nephew. I share these videos with my daughter. Like, they're looking out for these opportunities as well. So that younger generation, it's really like, okay, let's give them the information that we didn't get as students, you know, to learn about these different careers. And then there's the actual workers. There's the ones that are in their career that are looking to transition because they're unhappy, they're underpaid. They're looking for careers that they can break into, not entry level, but easy to transition. What kind of skills do they need to do that? And then there's the people that just want to make a lot of money, like the ones that are looking for the opportunities to advance, the ones that are looking to grow. It's interesting how these conversations can really go in so many different areas, but I think it's incredibly valuable that our audience meets so many, or our content meets so many different needs.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago about like how you learn from and engage with the audience. I'd love to hear more about how you do that and how you've built these like specific profiles. What are your like best avenues for engaging with your audience, and how have you gathered these learnings that you were just talking about?
Yeah, I definitely lend a lot of that back to my previous career as a data analyst. Like, data is everything to me, and I'm constantly analyzing and, you know, why is it this way? What are the numbers? And I think that's a valuable thing. It's definitely helped me. Because when I'm talking to people, you know, I'm learning about what their needs are from the comments. I'm trying to see if there's any trends, you know, have many people asked for this. I always jot notes. Like, I've gone through so many notebooks of just constantly being, because then if I don't write it down, I'll forget it, you know, and just trying to see what those trends are, reading emails, responding to emails, responding to DMs. People will reach out and say, hey, have you interviewed these people yet? I haven't seen it. And I'm like, okay, let me make sure that I go look at conferences or events in the area that might have those people. And I definitely look into it if I hear it more than once, which if one person says it, a lot of people usually want it. And what I love about TikTok especially is the likes. You know, you can see people will like a suggestion. And if you look at our videos, people will say, like, you should ask this question. Like, that is almost the most important thing, is people's feedback on the questions. They want to know. One thing that I know in the back of my head now that I need to start asking is, people want to know how much debt people have. Like, how much did your student loans cost? You know, because it's great that you're making $200,000 as an interventional radiologist, but like, how many years of school and how much debt did you go into? And are you still in debt? You know, that gives the full picture. I think that's really the name of the game, and our page is Transparent Street. They want that full picture. They don't want just the high level information. And, you know, when I look at the fact that we now have competitors in this space, you know, other people doing the same thing, I want to make sure that my audience trusts me and doesn't see my content and think, Cap, I hate this page. It makes me feel like crap. I want them to see my content and be like, Hannah's here. Like, this is going to be a good interview. I'm going to learn something. And that's just by listening to them.
No, that's amazing. I love the questions about debt too. Like, obviously that's so important. I was going to ask like how you, like, if you ever worry about like, not running out of ideas, because like, you know, you can go to any city.
Oh yeah, once a month.
Yeah, well, that, you know, it's the existential problem of being a creator. But how, like, I know, like, initially you were just in DC. Pretty quickly you expanded and started traveling to other cities, and now it sounds like you're like constantly developing the suite of questions you're asking. Like, how has the structure of how you do it? Because you go back, you look at one of the first videos, it's like maybe slightly less polished, but like much the same as what you're doing
significantly
now.
Significantly less polished. Like it hurts me to watch our first video. So but I'm it's like, still how so did good. We get here?
I mean, well, we can buy that video getting you 50,000 followers, right? But yeah. No, so my question is like, how have you changed the editorial strategy over time, and how has it evolved just on the TikTok for now before we get into the other platforms?
And TikTok was where we first launched. And I really do want to touch on what you said about the fact that it was slightly less polished. And I want to stress that to me, it feels significantly less polished because we edited in-app like for at least the first 4 months, you know, and we were very like harsh cuts. Like I was doing it. I'm not an editor. I have no experience in this. And but I think that what that experience taught me that I hope it teaches other creators as well is that you're right. That video that I look back on now and I cringe and I'm like, how did people watch this? It gained us 50,000 followers. Those videos gained us 600,000 followers because at the end of the day, it's not entirely about the finished product and how good the camera is and how good the editing is. You have to give people what they want. And in that moment, there was a complete lack of pay transparency in the country. Our page was one of the catalysts to normalizing these conversations. So if you can be the first in the market or bring something new and exciting to the table or deliver on a need that people have, don't worry about it being picture perfect. You can do something that's not fully polished and still have that impact. But definitely that content has changed over time. We've gone through a couple editors, you know, trying to make it better. At this point, I edit all our content, and it's because we've really figured out our style. You know, not just with the formatting and where the text goes and our colors, but like, what are the questions that matter? You know, there's a lot of fluff in the interviews as well. And, you know, on TikTok, now we have 10 minutes, but for a long time, we only had the 90-second limit. And so it was important to make sure that we were delivering within that short amount of time, which is difficult. But, you know, it's been a journey. And I think that we're constantly learning and we're never set on any final style. In the beginning, all our interviews were really quick compilations. You know, it would be multiple people within one interview. And then we started transitioning to individual interviews where it's one person per interview because we wanted to, you know, dive down deep into what is this person's career versus you don't get that if you just ask them, what do you do and how much do you make? And then go to the next person. What's really interesting there is we've started doing compilations more this year and trying them back out, and they performed really well. And so we're learning that, you know, you don't always have to stay married to one style, and they also have different value adds in different situations. Like when we shared our highest revenues of 2023, that made perfect sense for a compilation. But if I interview someone making, you know, 200K on the street, people definitely want to hear more about that story. And we leverage different platforms like YouTube to deliver on those longer style interviews. But style is something that's constantly evolving. And I think that as a creator, if you don't evolve your style over time or try new things, your audience might leave you behind as well because things are constantly changing.
Yeah, that's very astute. You have to always be, if you just stay the same, like you said, you've got these competitors rising up. One of them is going to come up and come up with like a new angle on it and move on.
Exactly.
So I want to talk about like what the act of like the woman on the street interview, right? Like I actually, a couple years ago in 2022, an old job, I had to do some of those for TikTok and like we ended up abandoning it. But, you know, I was going to Washington Square Park. And it's really hard. And like, in some ways, it's like, it's so simple. You go up to somebody, you get them to talk to you, and you do it. But it's also really hard. So I want to ask really about like the art of doing that. Like, what does it mean to you? How do you do it? How do you make sure that you get a good interview when you go up to somebody and like ask them to talk to you?
Street interviews are so difficult, and I wish we got more credit because they are so difficult to do right and to do well. And most of the time you cannot plan ahead. Like, we actually do interview 99% strangers. Only a small percentage, like probably less than 10 people we've interviewed on our page, are people who have reached out to us and been like, hey, I'd love to do an interview with you. I'm in DC. Can we meet at this time? And we coordinate. A lot of times I get kind of freaked out by people that want to coordinate, because I'm like, are you looking for fame? You know, and I try to look them up on their digital footprint. And if I've seen them on a competitor's page, I'm like, no, I'm not interviewing you. This is not the page. So we have to rely on strangers, and that can go so many different directions. We do largely interview in the DC metro area, but you know, we travel nationwide. And so when we're in new areas, it's incredibly hard to figure out where to stand, where to go, where is the foot traffic. And a lot of people will tell us, you know, why don't you come to small town, you know, Idaho? And I'm like, I would, but y'all do not have foot traffic. Like, this is, I need a city, because, you know, our statistic is, I think within an hour, if we ask like 10 or 20 people, we'll probably get 3 to 5 to say yes. And that's a good day. So, you know, think about the time that you have to put into it, the weather. If it's cold outside, that impacts whether or not people want to interview. You know, and I think we do have it pretty well down to a science, in the sense that I approach people who seem friendly. If they seem nice, if they make eye contact with me, I'll approach them. And sometimes I'll let several hordes of people go by, because I'm like, I don't know if they're a right fit. And it's not always a perfect formula, right? Like, people would not guess that I'm actually kind of shy and introverted. So doing that can be very difficult. Sometimes people will walk by and I'm like, oh, they were so great, why didn't I ask? But that's the name of the game. You really have to have a certain level of courage to go up to strangers. And my pitch to them that I think has been very helpful, in addition to having branding that we wear our logo so people take us seriously, because now there's so many street interviewers that you don't want to be the one that looks unprepared, that wastes people time, or that weirds people out. You have to be professional about it to be taken seriously. So I go up to people and I say, my pitch is, sorry to bother you. We're doing interviews for Salary Transparency. We ask people what they do for a living and how much they make to promote pay transparency. Can I interview you really quickly? And I wish I could get it shorter than that, because honestly, you have like 2 seconds before a person makes their decision on whether or not they will talk to you. And I think it's important to be respectful, to get to the point, to not waste their time. And if they say, I've got 2 minutes, you get right to it. So you have to be prepared. Camera rolling, mic on, you know, and I think that showing them, telling them what our mission is, why we're doing it, and the impact has elicited a positive response. People will say, oh, my colleague was underpaid and I helped them get a raise. Absolutely, I'll share my salary. Or people are like, yeah, you know, this is important. I'll talk about it, you know. And so I think it's important to talk about why you're doing it, not just like, what do you do for a living? Because then people are like, what's the point here? You know, and you won't get the right response. Because telling them, hey, we're doing this for pay transparency, you get the people that are like, let me tell you my story. I think this is important. And that's what we need on our page.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And like, it's like you said, it's so complex. And like, the weather thing, I think people wouldn't realize. And like, the ratio. Yeah, the ratio, you said like 3 to 5 per hour. I'm curious, like, how many hours are you spending per week doing this? Is it like once a month you go out? How do you actually, like, what's the harvest schedule, as it were, to like go out and create the raw content?
When we first started, we were going out every day. And that's kind of why we stopped doing the compilations, because, you know, you go out and you do 3 to 5 hours on the street and that's your video. And then you got to go out again and do it all over again. And very quickly that became, you know, not realistic. We could not support it. Thankfully, we don't have children living with us like full time, but I have pets, you know, we have a life here. And so it's important to balance that and not try to, you know, change things up too much. But, you know, when we first started, we were interviewing probably like 10 to 20 hours a week. in addition to, or not counting, you know, the travel and the editing and all the work that we did on the side, now it's a lot less. We usually go out once a week. We'll go out on a weekend, or we'll go out whenever we're traveling. So like, you know, we were in New York City last weekend for a conference. And if we have time, we'll do some street interviews like in between our travel and our hustle bustle. So we just try to take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves, but we do a lot less on the ground because it's just, now also being recognized, I am a little bit more hesitant about, you know, making myself widely accessible because I'm like, I don't want to get mugged. You know, I talk about money. And so there's a safety aspect of that too, to not make yourself so widely accessible.
Yeah, no, that's very complicated. One more question about this before we move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. What is, just a quick fire, what's the hardest place you've ever had to do this? And what's the mm-hmm. easiest place?
Yeah. No question. Hardest place to interview is New York City. Hands down, the hardest place. And it's so frustrating because it is the place with the best foot traffic. But people in New York are very like nose to the ground. They are on a mission. They have places to be. They will look you in your soul while you're doing your pitch and keep walking right by you. It's incredibly humbling. Every time I go out there, I'm like, all right, suit up, boys. Like, you really need like that confidence and that emotional armor and not take people's responses too seriously or to heart. Because, you know, at the end of the day, they don't owe you anything and you are asking for their time. So it's hard. But the easiest place to interview, I would say, was probably Eugene, Oregon. That was the most bizarre experience. It's a small, beautiful little town in Oregon. And that was the only place where in an entire day of interviews and walking around the city, which was probably about 4 or 5 hours, we didn't have a single person say no. Like, we ended that day, we went there on a trip and we were like, we need 30 interviews. We ended that day with like 15 and we had like multiple more days. And I was like, are we done? Do we get to go home? Like, it was so wonderful. I think that people were just really open and excited to talk about their careers. They also had different careers that we hadn't encountered before, like wildland firefighters, you know, who wanted to talk about what they do because they need more people to help them. And so, you know, they get good benefits. They wanted to talk about it. Tattoo artists, like just really cool people that understood that, you know, transparency isn't personal. We're not looking to make fun of you or use that information to harm you. It's to make awareness of your career and the possibilities within it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I didn't expect either of those answers. I thought like a New York or a DC might be the easiest.
Yeah. Now DC is becoming a lot easier because we get recognized a lot. Yeah. So it becomes easier in the sense that people know what I am looking for and they'll be like, I'll do it. You know, and so I don't have to give them the pitch and stuff. Mm-hmm. That makes it a lot easier.
You've got a groove there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on. And then maybe we'll come back to this. There's mm-hmm. much more to talk about here. Platforms. So you started with mm-hmm. TikTok, and now I believe you've got the TikTok, which is your biggest audience, 1.3 million.
Yeah.
Instagram, which is like 875,000 or something. Mm-hmm. Twitter is tiny. I think that's only like 3,000.
And then there's like 1,000.
No, you're at 3,000. I checked it. It's just under 3,000. And then you've got the newsletter, which I don't know how many subscribers you have there. I'd love to hear. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the salary database. Is there mm-hmm. a jobs board or is my mixing?
We're
that
working
up?
On it, actually. Okay. Yep, so that is in the works.
All these things. So tell me, I guess this might be meandering, but start from like mm-hmm. you launch the TikTok. When is the next thing you launch? And then like, mm-hmm. how does this keep developing up until today?
Yeah, so we have 6 social platforms. So we're on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And I think that nailing down those platforms and getting into a groove, you know, of posting consistently and just feeling more comfortable with them, that was the first step. And then as soon as stuff took off, we got a lot of people reaching out and saying, you know, hey, I'm not like, I can't be interviewed by you because I'm not in the same state, but can I share my salary in some way? And we started doing these What Do You Do Wednesdays on Instagram stories where I would ask people like, hey, can you share how much you make? And I didn't expect that we would get so many people, but it would be like, you know, scrolling for minutes through the responses. And I was like, okay, what do I do? Like, obviously we need to take this a step further. So we started a Google Sheet. It was a Google form that, and you could view it as a publicly viewable sheet that you couldn't edit, but it was accessible to everyone. So ugly, very like bare bones, you know, nothing, no frills about it. And we did that for a little bit because I had previously, like when I was in business school, well, for my undergrad, I had been involved in entrepreneurship and like I learned a lot about it. And the number one thing that I took from that was that you have to validate your idea first before you put money or time into it. And so I wanted to make sure like, hey, do we have enough of a demand for this? And that was proven very quickly because we got thousands of responses in that ugly Google Sheet. So I was like, if we actually create this into a beautiful product, you know, not only is it a better user experience, which delivers the value that we're hoping to have, but, you know, now we also have a product. Like, this is something that's valuable. We're not just a media company. We are a tech startup of types, you know, and I'm always thinking long term. I have a business background and I would like to do this for a long time. So I don't want to be, you know, the one hit wonder making content on the internet. I want to make sure that I have the exit and I've built something that will last. So the database really was that. It was our way of not only creating something that was off the platforms, that if we ever lost access to our TikTok, if TikTok were ever banned or what have you, we have this place for people to still be with us and have access to our product and our values. The job board is the most recent one because our database is now built. It is beautiful. It is operating, fully functional. So our job board is not even up there yet. It is still in its beta stages. But we're really excited about it because it is coming out this year. And that was taking it to the next step because what I've always done with managing the business is kind of looking at what I call my three C's. And they're my, how I look at our goals and what we want to do with the business. So community, corporate, and Congress. And they're the three groups that have the most impact with pay transparency. Community is obviously people. And so, you know, our content delivers that value, that transparency. Congress is legislation, which is what we've started getting involved in the past few months, is working with states. And just last week, I testified in support of Maryland's pay transparency bill. So like, really, that is full force ahead. We're getting involved with helping states pass the bills. The next part of the puzzle is corporate, getting companies on board because they kind of hold the keys to the castle. We can protest and be angry and complain all we want. And legislation can say, you need to do this. But companies need to actually buy into this to be successful. So, and no surprise, they've been the hardest nut to crack in this fight. So for me, I was like, how do I push this? And the transparent job board was a perfect solution. Not only do we get to platform and highlight jobs that are transparent and show you the jobs that they're hiring for, it normalizes the job search process of including transparent ranges within that. So mm-hmm. I think that that's really, we're just looking at making sure that our everything we create delivers to those three C's in some shape or form.
That's amazing. And I love like the social mission. You said something about like a couple minutes ago when you're answering that about like, you don't want to just be a media business, which obviously Salary Transparent Street starts as a TikTok account. It's a creator driven thing. Now it's like, you could really say it's a full media business. But yeah, mm-hmm. I see it becoming something else. Like, is, you know, does the salary transparency database like overtake Glassdoor as a thing? And then it's fully a tech startup, et cetera. So yeah. My question is what kind of business is it now? And like, what is mm-hmm. your 5-year plan, if you're willing to share it?
Right now, the business is very solidly a media company. Like, that is the foundation of our business. But with that comes our community and the community trust we've built. And using that, we've built our tech product, which is our salary database, and ultimately just our website, which is also has a resource hub that has tons of articles within it. We have a pay transparency map that you can navigate to see where pay is within your state. So it's really at that point, kind of like a worker resource. And I don't know if I'd go so far as to say it's software. But technically it is something that we built from the ground up that is not a Squarespace or Wix. It is our own IP. We own everything. And that I guess is software. So in a way, it's also employee helpful tech. I should probably figure out a good name.
EHT.
I love it. EHT, employee helpful tech. But really, like, that's what it is resources to help workers make more and earn more in their jobs and in their careers. So it's media, and then we've got the tech product to deliver that value.
Let's say 5 years from now, what's your dream?
Oh, yeah. Like, not necessarily a five-year plan,
but even just a dream, you know?
My five-year plan, I definitely would like us to not exit, because I don't want to give up what we've built or hand over the keys. It's my baby. It's my husband's and I, it's our work. We put so much blood, sweat, and tears into it. And I think that the value, or the reason that we've grown so much, is that we haven't sold out. We still are not even represented by an agency officially. Like, we're all in-house. And so I think our audience really trusts us because they've watched us grow. They've been there with us each step of the way. And I think to exit and leave them behind would be a disservice to them. So I don't ever see in the future myself stepping away from Salary Transparency, but, you know, I would like a vacation. And so I think that in the next 5 years, we would be expanding our interview cast, you know, so we're definitely planning on hiring, you know, representatives of STS in different states and different countries as well, expanding internationally. And I'd like to take more of a backseat to the business operations and also the legislative action, because that is very time intensive and something that really needs boots on the ground. So I wonder if I can get more involved in that sense. But yeah, I definitely see some type of an acquisition in the future where Glassdoor, Indeed, ZipRecruiter, one of these companies does recognize that we are a force in the space, and, you know, not just for looking for jobs like as a job board, but a salary database as well.
Yeah. Something you touched on there about, like, hiring more representatives of the brand. Like, I think with any creator brand, it's like, this is built on, like, your specific charisma and subjectivity and, like, way of speaking to people and making people comfortable enough to share their salaries, right? So it's like, it's very difficult sometimes to scale that kind of thing when it is just about one person and how they move through the world. And, like, that's what the audience connects with. So like, I don't know. And you're already starting to do this. Like, the newsletter, I believe, is not written by you, but it's like, it's very much like the way I sometimes think about this is like, let's say you're painting, you know, and you've got the watercolors, you've got the palette right here. You can just take the color right out and paint, and that's you. But then you water it down, and then, like, you get, the further you get from you at the core of the brand, the more diluted and, like, the less like the audience relates to it. So now I'm rambling a bit, but my question is just like, how are you thinking about, because it's a worry, I'm sure, how are you thinking about scaling this without losing the appeal that you have placed personally at the center of it? How do you navigate that?
That is a huge concern. And I think it's the direct reason it's taken us so long to do that. When we first started, we were inundated with messages from people saying, I can do this for you in Miami. I'll do this for you in New York. And we seriously considered it at first because, you know, we were like, well, we can't be everywhere at once, you know, and of course we'd get more content. Like, it made sense at the time, but the more we thought about it, we realized, like, it's not just the charisma, but also the brand. And I wasn't sure that I trusted strangers with representing our brand when we were still kind of figuring out what that was. Now, almost 2 years later, we've got a really strong brand identity. And I think that that's going to help us better cast these interviewers who, above all, have got to have the social activism piece down. They have to understand that we are not doing this for clout. We are not doing this for views. We're doing this for impact and social change. So incredibly hard to find those people, incredibly hard to cast. And I think it's the reason it's taken us so long. I'm definitely worried about it, especially with, you know, it's a complex action to coordinate, to get them the mic, to make sure they have a cameraman, because, you know, people don't know this, but my husband doesn't film on a tripod. He holds the camera. So, like, it's very much a dynamic between him and I that he, you know, can direct me where he needs me to stand, you know, and we're very in sync about that. You need to make sure that you're not just hiring a good interviewer, but a good cameraman. You know, there's so many logistics that go into it that freak me out. So I think that's why I'm more comfortable, like, just doing it ourselves, even if it means that we are trading, you know, possibly good content in different states we can't access yet. But I think that's okay.
So your husband, James, right? He's he's the cameraman. And originally it was just you two. And now I think you have a few other people. What are the roles you brought in? How many people work for Sally Transparent Street?
My first hire was my accountant, and she is about like $17.50 a month, but God, I would pay her double. And I wish I had hired her earlier, because she has been sort of a mentor to me. I found a really good accountant, and I strongly recommend that if you need people on your team, the most important people to hire that you have strong, you know, dynamic with, that you vibe with, that you trust, is your accountant and your lawyer. Those are people that you need to be on the same page with. And I'm so lucky that I have Stephanie in financial design, because they're my accountants. And every month we meet and she tells me, you know, this is where we're at, this is what we need to do. She does my taxes. And in the creator economy, your own finances is incredibly complicated, because you're, you know, W-9s and it's just all over the place. So that was my first hire. And I strongly recommend, as soon as you're starting to make over like $50,000 as a creator, find a good accountant, because they are worth the money. They will guide you in the right direction and make sure that you will not get, you know, in trouble with the IRS, which none of us want. The next people I hired was a lawyer. I started working on a trademark for Sally Transparent Street, which is just now has been approved like last month. And that was over a year long effort. Did not happen overnight. And we had bumps along the way, a very expensive venture as well. So unless you like are in it for the long term, I would not recommend looking for a trademark unless you're certain that, you know, that's something you want to trademark, because it is expensive, to the tune of like, I think I spent $15,000 on it, not counting my lawyer. So just a little tidbit. The other people on our team are our newsletter. We did our newsletter. I wrote it myself, and then I hired an assistant who's no longer with us. We did not need an assistant, it turned out. But I was doing the newsletter for myself, or by myself, for a couple months, and it was not my strong suit. It was taking a lot of time. It was what I realized was doing that, I felt like our newsletter was important. I didn't want to stop doing it, but it was sucking the life out of me. Like, it was not the creative that I liked to do. And I didn't want it to die because I wasn't utilizing my strengths. And so that's when we brought in Smooth, which is our newsletter production team. Phenomenal team. They write our newsletter every week. We talk about, you know, this is what we want to cover, this is what we want to highlight. I'm very involved in it, even though they are writing it. You know, I'm collaborating with them in the notes. I edit, review everything. So it's not hands off, but hands off enough that I'm not dedicating the hours that I was before. And I think as a creator, if you're doing this full time, it's very important to figure out within the week, what are you allocating your time to? How much energy is it taking from you? Because time is only one factor, but certain work can be more brain intensive than others, and it can really drain you. The sooner you burn out, the sooner you exit the creator economy. And if you want to do this long term, you need to figure out how to hand off the tasks that don't bring you joy, or that are too time intensive and not important, to other people that are smarter than you. That is the name of the game. Finding those people is incredibly hard, but when you do, paying them well and bringing them on the team and making them a part of the family is a recipe for success. Other people that we work with are, I have a part-time social media manager, but she doesn't manage per se. She has a full-time job. So she helps me with, you know, trends and figuring out what's going on out there. Because one of the things I don't have time for is scrolling TikTok endlessly and figuring out what is the funny sound of the week, you know? And so she helps me out with that. Other things that we hire for, I'm trying to think. I have a blog writer. That is, as you can tell, there's a trend here. I don't like to write. It's too time intensive for me. So I hired an amazing blog writer, Daniela. They are, they have an account called I Like to Dabble, and they create content about, you know, remote work and such, but an incredibly talented writer that I reached out to as a peer and said, hey, you know, can you write a blog for me for my website once a month? you know, something that's helpful, and they deliver on that every month, and it's money well spent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm interested. That's, I mean, quite the team. That's
and
like
my husband, of course.
Yeah, duh.
I feel like I forgot my husband. My husband is, oh gosh, I wouldn't, none of this would even be possible without him. He takes a very much backseat, you know, to this whole thing. He doesn't like to be on the camera. He is very humble about it, but really, like, the work that he does, just being there, just constantly like, okay, we're going to New York, let's go, I'm filming, okay, let's start. You need people in this if you want to do this. The support system you have and the team that surrounds you is what will make you successful. It's not you. It's not your talent or your brain. It's the people that uplift you and tell you that your ideas are good and help you execute on them. That's really what you need to focus on.
Yeah, which is, you know, people think being a creator is just a one person thing, which it can be, but I think the more you grow, it's not. I want to touch just for one more second on the writing aspects, but the newsletter and the blog, and like what those do for you, because you clearly do something for you. I think you started, I read that you started a newsletter when you were using Stan, again, just a couple months after you started the TikTok account, and then now you've been on Beehive since April of last year. So
yeah, sounds about right.
What does the newsletter do for you, and what does the blog do for you? And like, are you converting, you know, your followers to newsletter subscribers at a rate that you feel good about?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because actually I don't think so. I don't believe that, you know, the newsletter is, it's been hard to ration, because I think it's such a major product and something that we put a lot of effort into and money into each week. It's actually like our biggest ad spend technically of the month. And my accountant is always like, Hannah, you know, what is the outcome of this? What's the value? And it's really been a slow burn. And I think that's why I am not so freaked out about it, because we've experienced that astronomical growth with our followers, but we haven't seen that with the newsletter. And I'm like, okay, this is more personal. I like this. And so to me, I think it's also the ability of marketing something, you know, to get those signups is an art form and incredibly difficult. And what I've seen has been more successful for people to build those email lists is utilizing like chat funnels and like the DM me this word, you know, and they'll get an automatic link. I've been testing out that the chat funnel strategy, and it has been incredibly amazing. Like the feedback and the amount of signups we get on stuff is huge. So I think it's more so having access now to better tools to promote the newsletter will help it grow. But for now, it's been a slow growth, and I don't see that as a bad thing. I think the people that will subscribe to your newsletter are the ones that are less likely to unsubscribe in this day and age, because everybody is subscribed to newsletters. So if you have the ones that are reading, you really need to deliver on what they want, and you have that more personal connection with them. I think that that will help us grow in the long run. But, you know, ask me a year from now, if we're still, you know, going slow, maybe we'll reanalyze it. But there, with everything moving so fast, I'm okay with certain things moving slow.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So you're talking about outspend. Let's talk about inspend let's talk about revenue for a second. Okay. So I know I wrote down that you made 1 million last year in revenue, and 458,000 the previous year in only 8 months, which is crazy, from starting to half a million in just that first year. And now your goal is 2 million for the next year. And I also, the one more detail I know is that last year, about 97% of your revenue was brand deals, which is huge. And just 30,000 from the creator platform creator fees. So, first, let's start with brand deals. I know you started getting them basically as soon as you started making Salary Trends Brand Street, because as you said, you like, you know, the meteoric rise. So talk to me about brand deals and how you navigate securing them, and then also making sure that you get to, like, you know, renew them.
Yeah. Brand deals are our bread and butter. I think that they're important. You know, a lot of people are like, you need to diversify your income streams. I don't disagree with that. I am actively trying to do that, but I'm not mad that I can deliver content for free and resources for free to my audience in exchange for a partnership. Like, our partnerships with Indeed and Capital One have been so wonderful. And the reason they're so large is because we have that buy-in. We have long-term buy-in from them. So, you know, in terms of finding partnerships, it can happen so many different ways. Indeed was one that we had a connection through a connection. So networking is everything. Asking around, telling people who you want to partner with, even though that can be scary because you're like, you know, what if they steal my idea or what if they don't want to work with me? I feel like taking the risk has been better than not taking the risk because people are willing to help you. I think a lot of us have a negative view of the world that everyone's going to try to steal your idea. And yeah, I mean, be careful who you talk to, but like the majority of people are willing to help you. And so many people have so many connections. So just talking about who you want to partner with can open doors. And it's as simple as getting an email at that brand, somebody that works in their marketing department. In particular, if you can get somebody that works in influencer marketing or collaborations or partnerships, you're in the right department, you're in the right office, you're definitely getting close. And so it's as simple as having those email conversations with them. I've actually found that, because let me back up. You can also work with agencies to get partnerships. And I think a lot of creators, especially the larger they are, they have agents. And my experience with agents has been abysmal. They have not been as great as what everybody has told me. And what my experience has been is that my partnerships have decreased in value by working with agencies because you're working with people that are trying to, they only make money if you make money. And so there's definitely an incentive for you to work with brands that don't align with your values. And as Salary Transparency, our audience holds us accountable, as they should, to, you know, demonstrating those values in who we get money from. So, for example, we partnered with SoFi. I believe it was either earlier this year or late last year. And some people were upset about it because of the lawsuit with the student loan pause. And, you know, we had to come back and tell them the lawsuit was dropped. You know, we talked to SoFi. The reason we had avoided working with them for so long was because of that. But, you know, in a sense, that still wasn't enough for our audience. And so I think it's important to, before you sign, you know, partnerships, is making sure that your audience isn't going to react negatively to this. Does the brand live the values that you are living by on your page? If they don't, or if there's any type of, you know, head-on issue there, it's not going to be a successful partnership. And so if you work with agents, sometimes they don't see that. They just see a big brand that has a huge budget. And when you tell them this isn't going to work, they're like, well, let's just try it, you know, and then it doesn't work. And here we are. That's been my experience. But I know some creators love the agents that they work with. So my caution is just make sure that you work with agents that understand your values and your page's values and don't take that for granted. And that they don't take that for granted. But yeah, I mean, it's still incredibly difficult to work with brands, but I prefer to work with them personally because you get a better sense of what they're trying to accomplish. You can figure out, you know, the issues right then and there instead of having somebody in between that you don't, you know, if you don't have contact with the brand, it's less likely to, I believe, perform well. The more impersonal and like close connection I've had with the brand, the more the better performance it had.
So actually, one thing you touched on that I found really interesting is this idea of, you know, you are so accountable to your audience. And I usually I like to ask people like, oh, do you think you have a responsibility to your audience? Or what is that? Whereas for you, it's so clear and so baked in. So I want to ask about like, the pros and cons of that. Like, you are such a values driven brand, as you were just touching on with the SoFi thing. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the is that a double edged sword? What's the pros and cons of being such an audience accountable creator?
Yeah, it's definitely a double-edged sword to have so much accountability. But you know, it's a good thing, right? Like, you have accountability because you've created something that people value and you can't turn your back on that. You can't turn into somebody completely different, say this and do something else. That is the reason that we exist, is because we hate those people. We hate those companies. We're not going to be that. And so it is a double-edged sword though, because it limits who we can partner with, because we cannot partner with the bad apples of the industry. Like, I have been trying to work with Amazon for months now because they have an amazing certificates program. But just the other day, it was a headline that Amazon is trying to remove the National Labor Relations Act as a protection that workers can talk about their pay. What did I do? I told the agent that I have working on it, stop conversations. I posted about it on our Instagram story that Amazon is a bad actor, and I put a link that said Amazon sucks. That is being accountable to your audience, because if I hadn't acknowledged that and then gone and turned around and did a partnership with Amazon so close to the certificate, this announcement happening, I would have been torn to shreds and I would have lost all that trust that I built with my audience. It's not something that I want to gamble with, and I definitely don't want to lose it. So yeah, I will have to turn down $30,000, $50,000 here and there. But like, gosh, isn't that a crazy thing to say out loud? Like the privilege to be able to say, I can turn down that money. You know, like I'm not in a desperate situation, thankfully, because we partnered with the right brands that we work with long term, that we really trust and that deliver on those values. Having them and having the support of our audience that we know we can fall back on if we lost all our partnerships is so inherent to giving us confidence to make those tough decisions. And it's been the right decision every single time. Anytime we've gone against it, we felt the heat and it's been valid.
That's amazing. And major kudos to you for like having such strong principles. That's rare.
I'm not a hero.
Yeah. Well, so no, so next thing, speaking of not being a hero, another thing an interview I read with Elite Daily, you said, when people ask, what are you, an influencer or content creator? You said, I consider us social activists. And so I've been thinking a lot about like, well, what is a creator? You know, now you've been throughout this conversation referring to yourself as a creator. You said that when you started making TikToks, you didn't think of yourself as a creator. So my question is like, what is a creator? Which now you've built up such a relationship with being this, and you've probably interviewed plenty of people who are creators. What does it mean to be a creator? What is a creator?
That's a really good question. There's a really interesting conversation happening now that I've seen on LinkedIn about creators versus influencers. What is the difference? Where do they align? Where do they fall, you know, to the sidelines? And it's a very clear distinction to me that a creator, in my mind, is somebody that creates. You know, you have an idea and you turn it into something tangible. In my sense, I'm an internet creator. I create content from ideas that people put in the comments. You know, you should ask this. Great. I go on the street, I film it, and I make a video that I post on TikTok. That to me is being a creator. But why I don't align with being an influencer is because I'm not, and it's kind of tough because I do also see the alignment of being an influencer, because our work influences societal change. You know, it does have positive impact on the pay transparency movement, on workers earning more, on workers having more knowledge about their rights. But I'm also not influencing, you know, people to buy things or, you know, vlogging. And I just think that there's a distinction there between the type of creator that you are, because we're all creators, but some creators are influencers. I'm a creator who's a social activist. My ethos at the end of the day is to have social change, to impact social change, not to sell things on TikTok shop. And that's where I see the distinction.
Yeah, no, I know we're running out of time, but I want to share my definition too, just because I think it does
love to hear it.
Meld with yours pretty well. I've been defining it as like, number one is you're consistently creating content and publishing it online. That's hard rule. Number two is you have an unmediated relationship with your audience, which, you know, nobody, there's no editor or no like, you know, brand telling you exactly what to do. And then number three is like monetizing somehow, whether it's directly with a brand deal or whether it's like long tail, where it's like, this is like for my career and I'm trying to like build a presence online for my career. But then I think where an influencer is a subset of creator, where like they are not necessarily unmediated. They are mediated by the brand or something like that.
Yes. Great point. I love that.
What is one very tactical piece of advice you would give to other creators that they could apply today? And whether that's just like more general or specifically for video or like growing on TikTok or something, but just one tactical piece of advice you would share?
the number one, if you're making over $50,000 a year, get an accountant. Like, that is by far the biggest help, just because it'll help you not make stupid financial decisions. And it's incredibly helpful to help you grow as well. It's kind of generic advice, but I think it is very important, is consistency. And I know that's such a boring answer, but it's what you mentioned about the definition of being a creator. You cannot be a creator and show up once a week. It's not the way that the internet works anymore. Being a creator is kind of taking on this responsibility of showing up in people's lives. If people follow you, it's because they want to hear from you. And showing up daily or every other day is the best way to do that. It's also the best way to grow. You have to commit to it. And so if you're not in the place to make that commitment, I suggest, you know, not going all in unless you're ready. But, you know, at the same time, I would say if you have an idea, try it. Like going back to what I said about, you know, our content being unpolished, you know, in those first few videos, I wouldn't have known that I wanted to do that full time or that I wanted to commit to it if I hadn't tried it. So I think it goes hand in hand. You know, if you're inspired and you want to do something, commit to creating it. Commit to actually taking the plunge instead of sitting on your ideas and wondering what if. If I had wondered what if, I wouldn't be here today and there'd be tons of copycats and I'd be like, man, I had that idea, you know, and I'm still in my 9-to-5. Use that as fuel, you know, try things. And it's also okay to fail. There's been so many content ideas that we've tried on the page that have performed terribly, but they were fun and they kept the spark alive, you know, and somebody got value from it. So just don't be afraid to try, but also remember that consistency is the only way to grow.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The more I think about this stuff, it's literally just the Nike slogan, just do it. And that's
just do it.
So pretty lofty goal to go from 1 million revenue last year to 2 million this year. How are you going to pull that off?
Good question. It's going to be a mix of our brand partnerships, which is already about 97% of our earnings. But my goal is to diversify our income streams this year. So I don't think it'll be more in terms of double the brand partnerships. I think it's probably going to look like the same amount of brand partnerships, continuing what we've already started with the existing brands that we work with, maybe building on and exploring other partnerships. But that's probably going to stay about the same. What we are going to start introducing is our job board, which hand in hand comes with a job referral monetization strategy that we are going to work with companies to fill the slots that they are hiring for. And, you know, there's a couple ways that we're going to charge for that and work with recruiters to, you know, get a payout for that. But those partnerships, I think, can be incredibly lucrative, and they deliver on our ethos of helping people get jobs in a way that is transparent. So I'm excited about that. Other ways is, directly through our content. So we made like less than $30,000 last year from our actual content. You know, this is money that we made from the YouTube ad revenue program, creator fund, all of that. My goal is to create better content this year and even better, more viral, you know, really delivering on our audience's wants and needs, but having more fun as well and exploring other financial transparent questions, like how much did your tickets cost, you know, at the Super Bowl? I think that is helping us, you know, avoid the burnout, keep the spark alive, but also bring in more money from the actual platforms that we're placing them on. We're also working on new shows. We have one coming out this Friday, which is March 1st, depending on when this will air. So March 1st, our new show, The Break Room, is airing on YouTube. It's something we've been working on for like the last 6 months. And we're hoping that is really going to help us grow even further on YouTube and in turn increase our ad revenue there.